It's suitable to say, and now for something completely different at this point, because superconductivity, the theory, has permeated many other fields of physics, and it's appropriate at this meeting to discuss the theoretical implications of superconductivity theory that go beyond superconductors but into field theory. And our speaker is Tony Zee from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and his title is Superconductivity Beyond Superconductors.
I'm Tony Zee. I'm from the Institute for Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara. Given that I come from an Institute for Theoretical Physics, I'm afraid that I'm going to be somewhat out of touch with the real world compared to the previous speaker. So first of all, I'm extremely grateful to Peter Pesek for giving me this opportunity to talk. It's my first history talk at the APS. And we all know that this year, superconductivity was discovered in April 1911, exactly 100 years ago. So here are some reflections from a theorist. Okay, so in theoretical physics, we like to talk about the profound impact of one area of physics on another. We tell students about the importance of interdisciplinary research, and the funding officers tell us the same thing. And it's important to, as history has shown, to have a wide knowledge of physics. So superconductivity is often cited as the best example, the poster child. So as we all know, superconductivity had huge impact on electroweak unification. And perhaps it's not an exaggeration to say that unification of electromagnetism and weak interaction was very much based on superconductivity. So let's go back to 1954 when Yang Mills proposed what is now known as Yang-Mills theory. And the theory contains massless gauge bosons, which are not observed experimentally. And so there were really two ways out. And if there's a third way, we don't know about it. And perhaps some bright young guy could come up with a third way. So historically, it turns out that one way is, of course, to make these fellows massive. And the other is to confine them, is to make sure that nobody sees them. So the superconductivity story is what led us down the first possibility, that is to say, to make these gauge bosons massive, and that's what I'm going to talk about. So the first path was realized in, as I said, in electroweak unification. The second path is, of course, led to our theory of the strong interaction, QCD. Okay, so Ginzburg-Landau, that was 1950. Bardeen, Cooper, and Schiffer, that's 1957. So these are all golden moments in the history of theoretical physics. So Ginzburg and Landau wrote down the free energy, which we see here. And in modern language, if we set the order parameter, is there a pointer? Or oh, thank you. So we set the order parameter phi to V to a constant, then we see that in the free energy, we pick up a term quadratic in A square, okay, where A is the vector potential of electromagnetism. So we get some constant times A square. And what that means is that if you have a constant magnetic field, the gauge potential goes like x cross, the vector cross product of x and the magnetic field. So if you have a constant magnetic field, since it's the free energy density, you have to integrate this over volume. Since A itself grows linearly with x, the energy would grow scale much faster than the volume. So this is, of course, the origin of the Meissner-Oxenfeld effect that was discovered in 1933. Okay, so in quantum field theory, when you have a term like this, proportional to a squared in the Lagrangian density, it's known as the mass of the gauge boson. So as we saw in the previous transparency, one of the difficulties of Yang-Mills theory was that the particles, the gauge bosons, were all massless. So in hindsight, this is a mechanism for giving gauge bosons a mass. And so this is known as the Higgs mechanism. It was discovered in 1963 and 64. And as you know, the particle physicists have convinced governments to spend zillions of dollars to construct the LHC. And one of the purposes of the LHC is to look for this, to verify whether this mechanism is correct or not. Okay, so notice that the Higgs mechanism, it does not depend on BCS as such. But on the other hand, it's only after BCS did Nambu and Anderson recognize the relevance to relativistic physics. So on the spectrum in physics, we have typically we have a spectrum from the universal to the specific. So we think of a line, and I think the beautiful talk of the previous speaker we're concerned about very specific material, which of course we need to understand for specific applications. And BCS, of course, in the wide spectrum is somewhere here. And then Ginzburg-Landau, which is even more general, and so on, from the universal to the specific. So in theoretical physics, we often ask our question whether we can find some universal concepts. To me, that's one of the goals of theoretical physics, finding universal concepts that would be applicable to all theoretical physics. So in this sort of dichotomy between universal versus specific, we have to reach a very fine balance. So there are many pitfalls of theoretical physicists who think very generally. And a specific example, for example, is that a lot of theoretical physicists now like to work on biophysics. And in fact, I speak from personal experience because one of the things I've worked on in the past is the folding of RNA. And we use quantum field theory and methods inspired by quantum field theory and various techniques involving topology. But of course, when I talk to an actual biochemist, they're thinking of some medical application. So they only care about this RNA and not that RNA. So does that tell me about this particular RNA? I don't want a universal theory of RNA. Okay, so theoretical physicists, on the other hand, are always thinking of a universal theory. So I use this phrase, this and that, because that's Einstein's phrase. And Einstein himself said many times, I'm not interested in this and that. I'm only interested in the fundamental ideas. So basically, in our community, the fundamental outlooks differ, but the range is even narrower within theoretical physics. So one of the points I like to make in this talk is that in superconductivity, we have a microscopic theory, namely BCS. But even if the Higgs particles, and I actually think there's more than one, so that's why I put an S there. I don't for a moment believe that there's a single Higgs particle. In fact, there's probably a whole mess of them. That even if the Higgs particles were discovered, we still don't have the analog of BCS. We don't have any idea what's the mechanism behind the Higgs particles. So we're really at the Ginzburg-Landau stage, so to speak. So the concepts in theoretical physics, in one area of theoretical physics, migrating to another. This is, of course, one of the pride and joy of our profession, and it has a glorious history. So some examples of this is diffraction, which was first understood in water waves, then it's understood in sound waves, and then for the electromagnetic wave, and then eventually for the quantum wave. We now understand how quantum waves could diffract and go around obstacles. Another universal concept is eigenfrequency, and first understood in terms of vibrating strings, and then which led to quantization. And of course, in the last 30, 40 years, it's come back again as a vibrating string, but as a real vibrating string at some fundamental level. Now, Here, one of the universal concepts that I would like to talk about is spontaneous symmetry breaking. That was, of course, first understood as spin waves in ferromagnets, and in some sense understood already by Heisenberg. But the important thing in particle physics was that subsequently it was understood that the pi meson, the pion, was understood as a Nambu-Goldstone boson. So Nambu and Goldstone realized that when you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, you have a massless excitation, which in ferromagnets is the spin waves. Okay. Now, in physics, why do we need to search for the universal in theoretical physics? What do we actually gain? So, for example, Fermat had the famous least time principle for light. The diffraction of the refraction of light was already understood, but Fermat realized that one way of explaining it was not in terms of how the light behaves at the interface, say, between air and water, but that the light particle actually want to get there in least amount of time. So this inspired Euler and Lagrange and many others at the time to try to formulate a similar principle for the material particles, and this led us to the action principle. Okay, as a practical physicist, or as an applied physicist, you might say, who cares about the action principle of Euler-Lagrange? If I know Newton's laws, that's good enough. I can calculate with Newton's laws. So what do we actually gain? The point is that the subsequent developments often depends on these universal concepts. So, for example, the Dirac-Feynman path integral formulation of quantum mechanics, which is directly based on the action principle, it offers the most natural path to quantum field theory. So the action principle permeates throughout modern theoretical physics. So one example of this is how well known this little bit of history is. You know, Einstein, for some strange reason, he did not believe in the action principle. By the way, it was not called action at the time. It was called a world function. It's the function that describes the world. But Hilbert did. And Einstein had worked for almost 10 years to formulate his general theory of relativity, the theory of gravity. But he was struggling with the equations of motion. Einstein was trying to write down the equations of motion. So this is like Newton versus Euler-Lagrange. Okay? So Hilbert, on the other hand, just wrote down the action one day. So, in fact, Einstein was extremely bitter because he thought that Hilbert was going to scoop him. But, in fact, Einstein got full credit. So, the emphasis here is that a universal concept may be of great help in physics. Okay, so the Ginzburg-Landau turns out to hold the key to the electroweak interaction. This all seems quite obvious to us now. But that's only, in fact, this is taught to any student in the standard textbooks and so on, repeated ad infinitum, or I would say even ad nauseum. But that's in the glare of hindsight. It's an instance of staircase wit, right? The question is, could a bright young guy in 1954, 1955, 56, or even 57 have possibly seen the relevance of the Meissner effect and the Ginzburg-Landau theory to the dilemma facing Yang-Mills theory? Okay, so it was well known to people that Yang-Mills theory had this problem. And the other thing is, what lessons, if any, could we possibly learn? So I'd like to ask these two questions in my talk in the time remaining. So I can already tell you my answer to this question is no way, absolutely no way. I don't see how anybody could have seen that. So there are many, many... So if a bright young guy tried to sort of relate these two areas, he would come up with tremendous amount of obstacles. You know, what does Ginzburg-Landau have to do with Yang-Mills theory? So the first thing, if you're a bright young guy in 1955 and you try to think about this question, the first thing that would stump you is, what does the order parameter have to do with the field? Okay? Because at that time, quantum fields were not regarded as things that you can actually play with, you know. But now, you know, any graduate students play with quantum fields. But quantum fields are supposed to be highly singular operators, quantum operators. So even when I was in graduate school, the thing that I hear about all the time is don't mess with the quantum fields. You know, you don't mess with them. They're very singular. You know, you get hurt. So as some of you know, I've written a textbook on quantum field theory. And in my book, I refer to the shackles of Feynman diagrams. That's kind of maybe a little melodramatic. But in a way, it was true that the students were taught quantum field theory as sums of perturbative diagrams, as late as the early 70s, perhaps even now in some places. So when I was in graduate school, I was told to stay away from the singular quantum fields, that everything is defined by Feynman diagrams, by these funny diagrams, and that the operators are not well-defined. So then there's no way to relate Feynman diagrams to order parameters. Another question is, what does free energy have to do with the action in a relativistic quantum field theory? Well, they look similar. They're both functionals of fields, or at least of order parameters. But the way we learn about free energy, at least the way I learned it in graduate school, it's all tied up with mysterious concepts like temperature and entropy. Okay, so it would have completely prevented us from seeing the connection. So the lesson here, perhaps, is that we should look for very similar objects from different areas of physics. So the free energy is similar to the action, and the order parameter is similar to a quantum field. Another thing is, what does the London penetration length has to do with the mass of a Yang-Mills gauge boson? Well, again, in the glare of hindsight, any graduate student nowadays understands this. In fact, the key connection was pointed out in 1922. As the Compton wavelength, that the wavelength, which is a length, is given related to the mass of the particle by h bar over mc. So conceivably, someone could have seen the connection, but it would have really taken a stroke of genius. And the reason I say that is because Landau is basically a genius, although he ranks himself below Einstein. So as far as I know, nobody suggested anything remotely like that. Even Landau, who straddled condensed matter and particle physics, he did not see the connection. The great Landau, who was doing superconductivity and particle physics at the same time. Perhaps the condensed matter physicists in the audience don't realize that Landau, for example, were writing papers on neutrinos and all kinds of things at that time. So he was definitely doing particle physics. So the other thing, a Bray Young guy in 1955 would have been completely stumped, because the next question is, how would non-relativistic conclusions, which is basically a superconductor, the electrons are certainly non-relativistic, how would these conclusions hold in a relativistic context? Now, in hindsight, it is clear that the addition of time does not change anything essential, but it's, again, only in hindsight. So when you go from non-relativistic physics to relativity, you add time. And indeed, Higgs' first paper was in response to some confusion on this issue, and I will come to that later. So the deep concept behind all this, spontaneous symmetry breaking, I think this is really the deep concept behind this discussion. In fact, it dated back to Heisenberg and his ferromagnets. But it was first recognized as such in this context by Nambu, who is the real hero in this story. So my former boss, twice over, boss, so to speak, and because he hired me twice, namely Bob Schrieffer, he told me the following story. He said, notice that I actually looked up these ages for the purpose of this talk. In 1957, he was a graduate student. He was 26. And he told me that he was invited, after his paper with Bardeen and Cooper, he was invited to go over to the University of Chicago to give a talk. And he said the old guys, and he particularly mentioned Wenzel to me, gave him a terribly hard time, saying it was all, you know, that didn't make any sense, and so on and so forth. But the young guys, namely Nambu, saw the profound implication of BCS theory and for particle physics. So for the purpose of this talk, because I heard this story about 20-some years ago from Bob Schrieffer, when Bob Schrieffer was the director of the Institute for Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara. And in fact, I think I was he invited me over to his home for some hamburgers, and then while he was cooking the hamburgers, he was telling me how the old guys gave him all this trouble. So for the purpose of this talk, I was wondering how old these old guys are. So I finally looked it up. For some reason in my mind, I always thought of these old guys as being people in their 70s and 80s at the time. But in fact, Wenzel was only 59, God's sake. I would regard a 59-year-old as a youngster now, would you? So you see, in theoretical physics, the age really makes a huge difference. Okay. So now I'd like to ask a what-if question. Counterfactual history, very popular with historians. That's how you get tenure in history now. Suppose superconductivity had not been discovered. You know, perhaps refrigeration technology is particularly poor in this civilization. I mean, we don't have to talk about our particular civilization. There are a lot of galaxies out there. In some galaxies, you know, there are plenty of civilizations out there with physicists and so on. And what would have happened to electroweak unification? What would happen to particle physics? Okay. So this is my contrarian view, completely contrarian, which is not much. Because we always say how superconductivity had this huge impact on particle physics, on electroweak unification. So I think that by the 50s, Heisenberg's idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking had already been fermenting for decades. You know, remember that was the 1930s, so two decades. So some theorists will sooner or later ask what would happen in a gauge theory, in a Yang-Mills theory. In fact, Higgs's first paper received 27 July 1964. He did not mention superconductivity at all. For the purpose of this talk again, I looked up these papers. And in particle physics, you always say that Higgs was influenced by superconductivity. And so notice it's 64, not 57. So 7 years had to pass before particle physicists took notice. But his first paper did not mention superconductivity at all. It also did not mention Yang-Mills theory. Those words did not appear in the paper. But his second paper, which is received only a month later, he did mention both of these things and was written in what I regard as modern language. So 1 month made a huge difference. And I'm not a historian. If someone could tell me what happened in that month in 1964, I would be very grateful. Okay. Now, so I'd like to tell you a little bit about a little bit of history. So Higgs' first paper, in fact, mentioned two very confusing papers. And they sort of each counteracted each. They counteracted each other. They're both wrong papers. So the first papers were by Abe Klein and Ben Lee, so Goldstone bosons were known to people and so on. So at that time, Weinberg, Goldstone, and Salam have proved that the Goldstone theorem holds in relativistic theory, in quantum field theory. So this paper showed that Goldstone theorem could be avoided in the non-relativistic theory because there was an extra vector and mu that's available. That's a time-like vector pointing in the mu in a time-like direction. But then there was a subsequent paper by Wally Gilbert, whom some of you know, quit physics shortly after to go into biology, in which he won a Nobel Prize. So maybe it's the bit of experience in writing these papers that prompted him to quit. So Gilbert argued against Klein and Lee, and he showed that such a vector is absent in relativistic theory. So he showed that Goldstone theorem, in fact, applies to relativistic theory. So Gilbert wrote a paper and said Goldstone theorem applies to all relativistic theory. So Higgs's paper was to point out that Gilbert was wrong. So Gilbert said that, so Klein and Lee were wrong. Then Gilbert wrote a paper saying Klein and Lee were wrong. And then Higgs said Gilbert was wrong. And so Higgs was right, finally. So he said because gauge fixing introduced an extra vector. So that's the subtle concept for those of you who know what gauge fixing means. Okay. So a little bit more history, and then I'm almost done. I see our chair getting a little bit worried about very wordy, verbose theorist. A little bit more history. Now, Anderson's paper, which was received, notice, 8th November 1962, so that was almost 2 years earlier compared to Hicks' paper. He, in fact, starts the abstract by saying, Schwinger has pointed out that Yang-Mills vector boson does not necessarily have zero mass if such and such. So, in fact, Schwinger, the great Schwinger, you know, had actually had pointed this out. Okay, and I think poor Schwinger didn't get any credit. Okay, so I heard in one of the APS sessions this morning that in a journal, Jocular Physics, it was suggested that all field theory paper should start with the phrase, according to Schwinger. So Schwinger has pointed this out, he said. And then he talks about Sakurai's 1961 attempt to use Yang-Mills for the strong induction. So this is all forgotten by the younger generation by now. And in a way, Sakurai, the poor Sakurai who passed away, he should have interchanged the strong and the electroweak. Because the strong was later discovered to be QCD, right? So also applied for Yang-Mills, but it was by a different mechanism. So Anderson, in fact, wrote a very nice paper in which he concludes, and here are his words, considering the superconducting analog, the way is now open for degenerate vacuum theory of the NAMBU type. He actually calls the theory of the NAMBU type without any difficulties involving either zero-mass Yang-Mills gauge boson or zero-mass Goldstone boson. So this was the problem facing particle physics at the time. The Goldstone boson was zero-mass. The Yang-Mills particle is zero-mass. And he said these two types of bosons seem capable of canceling each other out and leaving finite mass bosons only. In the textbooks now, we say that the Yang-Mills gauge boson eat the, we use the word eat. So in particle physics, the Yang-Mills gauge boson eat the Goldstone bosons. Okay. So transporting the concepts from one physics problem to another, this has a, I have shown in this talk, this has been a very fruitful way of making progress. So it's the method of analogy in theoretical physics. So a possible example of this, one of the, and this is something very close to my heart. I guess I'm almost, time is almost up, is that right? Yeah. So this is my last transparency. So a possible example of this, very close to my heart because this is something that I've been advocating for a long time, is that the greatest, one of the greatest paradoxes facing theoretical physics today is, of course, the cosmological constant paradox. It is the most humongous discrepancy between expectation, dogma, and observation in theoretical physics. So many of you heard that the discrepancy between observation and theory is a factor of 10 to the 120. And I would like to ask, and this is something I've been advocating, whether it can be solved by appealing to proton decay. The proton decay story is an analogy. So in order to avoid pesky referees, I've only proposed this theory at various birthday. So if you look at the proceedings, You could read about these ideas. Dirac's 80th birthday, Yang's 85th, and Gell-Mann's 80th recently. Okay, so I conclude, and unfortunately I don't have a stirring, inspiring conclusion. I have a very, very lame conclusion. I couldn't think of a good conclusion. So my conclusion is, where would the next great idea in particle physics come from? We don't know. So that's it. Okay. Yeah, sure.
We have time for some questions. I have a comment on this since birthdays come into play. This is just a few weeks ago was the 100th anniversary of the birth of Maurice Goldhaber. And a comment that can be made here, Maurice Goldhaber was very interested in possible proton decay.
Exactly.
And he had an appropriate biological way of identifying it. He said you would feel it in your bones.
Exactly.
Because the radiation would do appropriate damage there.
Right. So that can I make a comment on that story?
Yes.
Because I also know Maurice Goldhaber and very fond of him. This quote, actually, Glashow also tells a story using this quote, which was that when Glashow applied to graduate school at Princeton, he was interviewed by Wigner. And Wigner asked him several physics questions, and Glashow went to the board and wrote down the appropriate equations and showed that Wigner he knows showed Wigner that he knew his stuff. But Wigner said to him, "Young man, I reject you because you know the equations, but you don't feel it in your bones."
Okay. If there are no further comments or questions, then let's thank all of our speakers for an excellent session.